The Black Talk Media Project is a North Carolina-based nonprofit media education organization committed to the creation and promotion of new media for the new millennium. Through our websites like blacktalkradionetwork.com and our social media profiles on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, we have been able to reach out and touch close to 2 million people in 2012 alone. If you would like to support our continued efforts, you can make a donation via PayPal buttons on our website or send a check or money order to our address made out to Black Talk Media Project, P.O. Box 65, Mount Holly, North Carolina, 28120. Make a donation today and support independent media. Welcome back. You're listening to Black Talk Radio News with Scotty Reed and our guest tonight that we have on the line to discuss what's going on, what has happened in Libya, and what is going on in Africa as it pertains to U.S. foreign policy, and not just only the U.S., but Europe as well as their partners through NATO. So we have on the line Dr. Maximilian Forte. He has a new book out that came out on November the 20th called Slouching Towards CERT, NATO's War on Libya and Africa. Thank you for joining us and taking the time to speak to us, Doctor.
Well, thank you very much, Scotty, for inviting me. It's my pleasure.
Well, this is something that I have been following. I wrote an article about this, and, you know, I just wasn't buying the mainstream media narrative about what was going on in Libya. The reason why I wasn't buying it is because I, you know, subscribe to a number of alternative media outlets, and, you know, they were saying something different. And after doing my own research, I found that, you know, we were being lied to yet again to get America yet in another military conflict. And so I just want to thank you for your book and shedding some light on this issue. How long has the United States, through its corporate partners and NATO partners, have had designs on Africa?
Oh, that's difficult to say, in the sense that from a certain point of view, you could say it stretches back to centuries before NATO even existed. But certainly, the U.S. has developed a renewed interest in Africa, especially since around the year 2000 to around 2002, when a number of policymakers, military strategists, various lobbyists from the oil industry began to identify Western Africa and especially the Gulf of Guinea region as a key source of strategic oil imports for the United States. They identified Africa as a likely source of oil for the United States that would surpass the Middle East within a few short years from now, and also the fact that the African continent possesses either all or the majority of a number of strategic minerals that are required by the Pentagon itself for its own defense industries. And so a number of defense contractors that work for the Pentagon rely on a supply of these minerals in order to produce everything from jet engines to communications equipment, weapons, and so forth. So certainly since the beginning of this century, there's been this kind of renewed interest, and one of the ways of securing this access and ensuring a steady supply of these resources was through the development of a new so-called combatant command, which is AFRICOM or Africa Command. So in a nutshell, those are some of the key developments.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned AFRICOM. That's been on my radar for a number of years. African Command actually is not based in Africa. They wanted to base it in Africa. I think Liberia was one of the countries that was open to allowing them to host it or to put a bases there for African Command, but it was rejected by a number of members of the African Union. And I would also say that Muammar Gaddafi, the former leader of Libya, also, you know, led the charge in trying to keep American troops out of Africa.
And yes, sorry, that's a very key point. I hope you don't mind me interjecting for a second. Gaddafi, and this is something that has been revealed extensively in the diplomatic cables that were published by WikiLeaks, Gaddafi consistently made it very clear that he was opposed to an American military presence in Africa and to the establishment of bases in Africa. And when it comes to Liberia, as you mentioned, Gaddafi did something else. He basically acquired some degree of influence and even the friendship on part of the Liberian leadership by funding and developing various rice programs in Liberia that would allow Liberia a much greater degree of food self-sufficiency. And even the U.S. Embassy in Liberia pointed out the fact that it was a very ambitious project, that it was succeeding, and that the price of rice, the basic staple in Liberia, was one of the root causes of past unrest and rebellions and so forth. So what Gaddafi was achieving in Liberia was something extremely significant, and Liberia began to tilt towards Libya, something that obviously would have caused the United States a great deal of concern. So there was a kind of generalized opposition to having an American military presence in Africa. There actually is. There is a, you might call it a permanent base in Eastern Africa in Djibouti, but the headquarters of AFRICOM remains in Stuttgart, Germany. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I appreciate that information. I think it is very important to note some of the things that Gaddafi was doing in Africa. He was credited with helping to develop a lot of infrastructure. I think Libya has been described as, well, pre-NATO bombing, one of the most developed countries in Africa. And he not only used the oil wealth of his country to develop Libya, but also he used that revenue to help other African countries. Very ambitious in the development of Africa. I also read recently that he was even planning to launch a satellite for communications for Africa so they didn't have to rely on the West again. Is that correct?
The satellite actually was launched, so that was a successful project, and it reduced costs of telecommunications within Africa. It reduced the dependency on outside providers. It eliminated any possible role for agencies such as the World Bank to be involved in funding these programs, and therefore creating a new layer of dependency and of capital exportation. So yeah, that is something that has been achieved and that has been done. Some of the other more ambitious ideas, those were cut short by NATO's intervention, of course.
Now, speaking of NATO's quote-unquote intervention, at first I was kind of like falling for mainstream media's propaganda. Some of the things that I heard Gaddafi say, some of the sound bites that they put out there, I was like, wow, this guy shouldn't be saying that. And, you know, I didn't have a grasp of all the facts. And some of the other people I have interviewed have blamed some of the human rights organizations, well-known organizations, for helping to push this lie that Gaddafi was going to slaughter these people who were actually committing armed insurrection against him. So does your book talk about any of that?
Oh yeah, absolutely, because, you mentioned quite a few things, all of which are very important. I think I shared some of the same sentiments, and at the very beginning, you know, I was hearing reports about aircraft and anti-aircraft guns being used against unarmed peaceful protesters, and I thought, what the hell is happening in Libya that it should reach such an extreme all of a sudden? And there was, of course, the famous speech that Gaddafi gave in front of the ruins of his compound that had been bombed by the U.S. in 1986. But everybody says, you know, it's where he threatened to basically wipe out Benghazi and so forth. Now, that's such a key historical speech. You would think that it would be everywhere and that it would have been fully translated, at least by now. Mm-hmm. And even to date, there is no complete translation or transcript of that speech. And those who listen to the whole speech and who know Arabic, but not just Arabic, know Libyan dialect and so forth, and were able to follow Gaddafi, accurately reported that he never threatened to wipe out Benghazi, that he never threatened to wipe out the rebels, that he was actually providing them with escape routes of amnesty and so forth, calling for negotiations, calling for discussions, which he repeatedly did throughout the length of the war. Each time his offers for discussion and negotiations and so forth were rejected out of hand. I was also, what started to make me begin to doubt the kind of mainstream narrative that was being pushed, as alarming as it was, were videos that were being shown, you know, on CNN and other of the major news outlets, of these so-called African mercenaries. You know, and I was looking at this very carefully, and I would see a lot of black men wearing yellow safety hats. And I thought, these are mercenaries? They look like construction workers. They're also carrying 2x4s, not guns. I'm not seeing any protesters being killed, not seeing anyone being killed. In fact, I'm not even seeing any violence. I'm just seeing them running around on the street. If anything, they look rather scared to me. And, you know, with a bit of background, you understand that Libya had become heavily dependent on imported workers from across Africa, precisely in the construction industry. Mm-hmm. And I thought, between Amnesty International and CNN and others like them, they're helping to create a climate in which these people, who are innocent and who are workers, are going to be targeted, as in fact they were. So that even though the media was focusing on the number of protesters killed, they were ignoring at the same time the number of Africans that were getting outright lynched. Mm. And it was a far greater number. So from the very beginning, there was this very, very alarming racial slant and racial bias in the news coverage, in the meaning of what humanitarianism was and so forth. That I found rather, to this day, it is very depressing.
Speaking of those African workers, again, this is an issue I've been following ever since it first started. And even today, I have not seen any mainstream media reports. I have not heard any Western governments, including the United States, that are addressing the humanitarian issues that are going on right now. One interview I had done with somebody from Libya, and they told me about the town of Tawarga, which was predominantly black African, about 30,000 people, and how it had become a ghost town. Then I started seeing videos pop up on YouTube of these black Africans being bound and gagged and just being mistreated by these Arab fighters. And, you know, and I'm saying this is ethnic cleansing that is going on here. But yet to this day, that story has not been told by mainstream media, and it has not been acknowledged by the United States government.
No, that's exactly right. And this is also one of the things that I talk about in the book, that when people started using, you know, at the UN and again the various human rights organizations started using the term genocide and started warning that what might be in progress in Libya back in February of 2011 is a sort of impending genocide. It's very interesting that the closest we ever came to anything that might be acceptable as being, you know, defined as genocide was, for example, cases like the one you mentioned about the complete depopulation of Tawarga, and even to this day, all of those families are being refused re-entry to their homes. And, you know, we're talking about innocent non-combatants here. And the closest we came to anything that could be called genocide were things such as that. And that's precisely where we heard all the silence, particularly from the U.S. government. Amnesty International has tried a little bit to play both sides of the street, because either way it benefits. Anytime it can speak about human rights abuses done by one sort of, or one party or another, it benefits. So right now, Amnesty International, of course, is paying greater attention to that. At the beginning, they were completely ignoring these prospects and possibilities for Africans getting targeted. But in the end, and of course, there's the fact that up to 8,000 individuals remain in prison in Libya without charge, without trial. I believe the estimate is that at least a significant minority of them, about 40%, almost 50%, are themselves either African migrants or black Libyans who've been abducted in many cases right off the street simply because of the color of their skin. I mean, I'm not sure I understand what is happening in our society these days, because when apartheid existed, we seemed to have, many of us, to have been completely outraged at the idea of black people being targeted for their color, for their race, and so forth, and being subjected to injustice, to grave human rights abuses. Now that it's happened in Libya, and it's happened under the cover of NATO bombings, there's this absolutely deafening silence. Man, I'm starting to wonder if we live in countries that are populated by zombies, because nobody seems to be listening.
Mm-hmm. And as a black man myself, it's particularly troubling to me that most of the African population, African descended population here in the United States, many of them would support President Obama and his administration, and were even cheering for Susan Rice to become Secretary of State. It's just troubling to me that these people are, I would say, willingly ignorant of the facts of what this administration has actually done and is doing in Africa. So that's just very troubling to me.
Yeah, that's actually a very good point. I mean, when you look at who was the loudest, but also one of the most eloquent and clearest critics of the war in Libya, it was Louis Farrakhan who really stood out prominently, and he gave some very, very powerful analyses that I followed throughout the duration of the war. And I thought this has been probably one of the most clearest, most sober, and most articulate perspectives that really dismantled the justifications for the war and the implications of the war. And on the other hand, I would have to say at the other extreme, you have members of what, you know, they call themselves the Black Congressional Caucus, coming forward to defend Susan Rice. And it's just astounding to me, because Susan Rice herself was the source of one of the ugliest myths that was used to slander Libyans fighting to maintain the Gaddafi government in power, fighting against the insurrection and so forth. And that myth was that Gaddafi forces were being powered by Viagra, and that they were being given Viagra so they could go on a systematic rape spree. And, you know, this isn't a case where, like in the recent episode in Benghazi and the killing of the U.S. ambassador, where her statements, you know, people are saying, oh, she was given bad intelligence. This isn't a case of bad intelligence that I'm talking about. Her Viagra claims she completely fabricated. And the day after, U.S. intelligence agencies went to the media and reported, you can read this on MSNBC and so forth, there is no intelligence, no information whatsoever to confirm anything that Susan Rice had just finished saying at the UN Security Council. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they had forgotten all of these things. They had forgotten her positions on Africa going back to the 1990s when she worked in the Clinton administration and so forth, and that she's a person who was quite happy to live with genocide as long as the genocide is committed by U.S. allies. So I was really astounded. I was astounded by the amnesia, by the selective and closed vision, and by the ultimate betrayal of their own interests that really, really took me back, I think.
I have to agree with you there. Now, most people say that, okay, they must be after the oil because, I mean, you know, we look at Iraq, we look at other military actions in the region. And so, you know, somebody who thinks that they were after the sweet crew that was in Libya, they wouldn't be, you know, that's not too far-fetched. But from a review I read of your book, it states that that's not the only reason. And before we get into some of those reasons, you know, this kind of like when I started really digging into this, you know, I was like, well, why would they overthrow Gaddafi when he was helping them in the war in terror? You know, Gaddafi's never been what you might call a fundamentalist Islamist or anything like that. I think his government was pretty much secular, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And so he also, you know, was helping to secure the borders of Libya to keep, you know, people from just bum rushing into Europe. But he also, the CIA was openly, you know, operating in Libya with Gaddafi's government's blessing and had, you know, actually arrested and imprisoned a number of these radical Islamists that they like to talk about so much.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's start with the question of a war for oil. Of course, this is a kind of unfortunate trap that some people have unknowingly created where they, you know, as a means of criticizing a war, they'll say that, you know, this is just a war for oil or another war for oil. And of course, people in power listen to these things or they hear these statements and they begin to manipulate them. They say, okay, so you think a war is bad if it's a war for oil. What if it's a war for human rights?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe then you'll go quiet or you'll actually support us. And that, from that point of view, they did successfully manipulate a good degree of public opinion because they did cast it as a war for human rights. It doesn't mean, by the way, that oil wasn't significant. Gaddafi, on repeated occasions, had shown what the U.S. Embassy referred to in its private cables as resource nationalism, that he seemed to be taking American oil companies in particular hostage, making them liable for the payments to the Lockerbie families and so forth, the victims of the Pan Am 103 bombing, for which, by the way, just to make it clear, because a lot of people do get this key point very wrong, Libya never admitted guilt to that. So this is another very interesting story that could occupy a books of its own. But in any case, the key economic interest, of course, is Libyan construction contracts, which in terms of immediate gain offered much more than oil. We're talking about $150 billion worth of investments in construction in Libya itself. And that's an awful amount of money for a lot of American companies to just let pass. And Gaddafi was locking out a number of key American corporations, including ones with serious political ties, such as Bechtel, which has been tied to a number of Republican administrations and to people who served in the Pentagon and the CIA and so forth. And, you know, one of the United States' largest, if not the largest, defense contractor and so on. But, you know, and you also made the point about the war on terror. This is another thing that a lot of people tend to get backwards. The Libyan war on terror, if you want to call it that,
okay,
preceded that of the United States.
Okay.
The very first arrest warrant issued for bin Laden internationally was not issued by the United States, it was issued by Libya. What I think the United States resented all along is that a lot of Gaddafi's anti-terrorism kept pointing the way towards Saudi Arabia, which is such a vital U.S. ally. So this is a case where the war on terror, as fought by local interests such as Libya, could go counter to United States' larger, you know, geopolitical goals. Yeah, sorry.
That's interesting. I did not know that. And, you know, they're even saying now, you know, it's long been said that the United States, especially through the CIA, has used what some people might call terrorist groups. I think I've heard the phrase used as retail terrorists. I think Glenn Ford called them. You know, they're not really fighting for a cause or for a religion or anything like that. They're being paid to do this. And I've even read that a number of these same Libyan Islamists are now making their way towards Syria if they're not there already.
That's right. Oh, and by the way, I'm glad you mentioned Glenn Ford, because he's another of the persons in the United States who's been consistently great at analyzing and picking apart what's been going on in Libya, and I have a lot of respect for him and his work. He's right to make those comments about retail terrorism, but, you know, also there's the fact that the United States acted in Libya knowing full well that there were organizations that either were formerly or currently allied to Al-Qaeda itself, or that, you know, shared a lot of its basic ideology. Normally, these are groups that might be, presumably targeted by the United States. But obviously, both sides, both the United States and these other individuals, were willing to hold aside any latent or implicit disagreements and friction or hostility, and essentially work together. Maybe saying that they're on the same team might be going too far, but certainly there was a degree of convergence, overlap, of low in hostilities, because both shared the aim of overthrowing Gaddafi. Even Gaddafi's much-touted human rights abuses, because I think we've all heard at what an evil and pernicious abuser of human rights he was. A lot of those that were the targets of his so-called human rights abuses were precisely those sorts of people that the United States has stuffed its jails full of in Guantanamo and its various secret jails in Afghanistan and elsewhere. I mean, so it's a bit rich to hear American officials talking about Libyan human rights abuses, you know, especially when we were talking about some of the exact same targets of that abuse.
We are talking with Dr. Maximilian Forte. He has a new book out. It is called Slouching Towards CERT, NATO's War on Libya and Africa. Doctor, where can they purchase this book?
Well, it's available. Well, pretty well, it's available from any online retailer, but it might be available, I think, more cheaply directly from the publisher. And the publisher is Baraka Books. Baraka is B-A-R-A-K-A. And I think it might be a bit cheaper than some of the online retailers anyway. But it's available anywhere one wants it.
Mm-hmm. Now, as we get ready to wrap up, I have to ask this question. This goes back to when it first started, and, you know, I, again, immediately was misinformed about a lot of issues and didn't really know a lot about Gaddafi's role or his partnership with the West in the so-called war on terror. And I once stated that, you know, well, you know, when you play with the devil or you play with fire, you might get burned. So I was like saying he kind of invited this on himself by working with, you know, the United States in its phony war on terror. And I understand from this review that your book kind of addresses that.
Yeah, that's certainly, you know, this is certainly one aspect. Is the United States has basically, by helping to dismantle what existed in Libya up until 2011, has it essentially created a kind of scorched earth, meaning things are wide open now. All kinds of competing interests and very combative interests that were sort of held at bay are no longer, you know, they're unfettered now. So you have a movement of fighters and weapons across North Africa, and as you mentioned, from Libya to Syria, and that's also an established fact, and the CIA is playing a role in that. But these are not the sorts of, how can I put it, what Americans would necessarily call reliable partners. These are groups that have their own ultimate agenda, and it doesn't necessarily correspond with that of the United States. They're not there to protect and defend U.S. interests. They've got their own interests to look after. And in some cases, well, of course, there's still some dispute, huh, about who was responsible for the attack on Ambassador Christopher Stevens. The common assumption is that it was an Islamist group called Ansar al-Sharia. There are others, though, who are suggesting it's possible that it's people who are loyal to Gaddafi that targeted the ambassador. I'm not convinced either way. The evidence that's being presented that it was an Islamist group has been presented by the mainstream media and with information supplied by the White House. So, you know, a grain of salt. I think we'll need to wait a bit longer before we can be sure of what happened. But definitely, this is an environment that's fraught, obviously, with a lot of risk for the United States, but their calculation is that the opportunities would outweigh the risk. The opportunities for investment, the opportunities for a new role for AFRICOM, the opportunities that come with making the United States somehow an indispensable party to the conduct of African politics. They're hoping that all of these things will somehow outweigh the risks. Ultimately, I think they're wrong. Ultimately, I think this is going to cause them a very big setback.
Mm-hmm. Again, we have been speaking to Dr. Maximilian C. Forte. His new book is Slouching Towards Certain, NATO's War on Libya and Africa. And as he stated, you can purchase this book at BarakaBooks.com. That's BarakaBooks.com. Well, Doctor, I want to thank you again for taking the time out of your day to share this information with us. And I always like to give a guest the last word on a particular issue. And what do you see looking forward? Do you see further destabilization of Africa? What do you think we can expect over the next 4 years?
Well, you know, by nature, I'm a pretty pessimistic person to begin with. Unfortunately, Libya and countries surrounding Libya are giving me a great deal of reason to continue being pessimistic. I think there's going to be a great deal of unrest, of civil conflict. I don't think Libya is going to be on a stable footing for a very long time to come, and I think Libyans are about to start experiencing something they haven't experienced in a couple of generations, and that's going to be outright poverty. Poverty without the kinds of civil liberties that some of their elites imagined that they would be obtaining as a result of overthrowing Gaddafi. Already, what few civil liberties they've won have been rolled back or severely curtailed in different ways. So I think Libyans are going to be paying a very high price for what's happened, and I'm extremely sorry to see this happening. We've also lost a leader who, for all of the negative things that can be said and have been said about him, was, in a sense, a visionary, certainly the most altruistic Arab leader I can think of. I can't think of any other Arab leadership that's been present in a number of national liberation struggles around the world that's assisted in the development of various countries around the planet. I can't think of any other Arab country that's done anything like that. So this is ultimately a loss. It's a very big loss, and I'm very, very sorry for it.
Well, thank you again, Doctor. Doctor, do you have a website that you would like to promote for people to follow your work?
Actually, yes. My website is openanthropology.org. Open Anthropology has one word.
Well, Doctor, again, thank you for joining us today.
And thank you very much for having me. I really, really appreciate it.
Blank Talk Radio News. This is Scotty Reed. I want to thank our guest, Mr. Sharif Hamid, who joined us on the first part of the broadcast talking about our children, all of these psychotropic drugs, the dangers of the drugs that's out there on the streets. You know what I say, legalize them and get them off the street. That way our kids won't have ready or easy access to them. Also want to thank Dr. Forte for joining us and sharing his commentary on Libya and Africa in general and the Western designs that they have for the continent. It's just terrible that so many people are misinformed about what the United States government, this administration, and players in this administration have been up to in Africa. And I just think, like Neely Fuller spoke on racial showcasing, that has really thrown a monkey wrench, so to speak, into the understanding of what's going on in this world in terms of the assault on black people throughout the world. When you have black faces in position of power, then all of a sudden, it's cheering for them, living vicariously through them, like they're celebrities or something like that, and then, not paying attention to the policies that they are creating and enforcing that is harming people. I don't think we can afford to allow ourselves to be tricked in such a manner. We should, always check everybody's background. We need to be looking at everyone's action and what they're actually doing as opposed to what they're saying. All right, so closing out the broadcast, we'll be back on the air Monday at 10 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. Make sure you check out some of our media partners over the weekend. The Cows, Context of White Supremacy, does the Saturday night compensatory call-in at 9 o'clock. Speaking of, you heard Dr. Forte mention Minister Louis Farrakhan, his broadcast will be at 7 a.m. on BlackTalkRadioNetwork.com on Sunday. Check that out. And then I think you also have A Word with God with Pastor Willie Woodson comes on at 4 o'clock. So, again, if you're not a member of the Black Talk Radio Network, please join. It's free to join. And you will always get an email blast letting you know about some of the upcoming programs. All right, so everybody have a safe weekend, and I hope that you will be back here Monday. Good night.